call to order the House Revenue Committee meeting. Sure has the feel of a late session meeting today when you have to lobby up at the desk until the last second. Last minute amendments. We have two items of business before us today. Senate Bill 858, of course, we took care of that yesterday, so that's done. But we do have bill introduction, and you have before you an LC draft 3606, for which we have approval to introduce as a committee bill. And so the chair would move introduction of LC 3606 as a revenue committee bill. Understanding, of course, as always, since it's been a while, that introduction as a committee bill doesn't indicate any degree of support for the bill, but it just gets it into the process. Is there any objection to the introduction of LC 3606 as a committee bill? That bill is in. Then let's go to a work session on House Bill 2368, which seems to have some interest to it this morning. Okay, for those of you who need to be caught up, we are down to one issue and three amendments. Basically, is where we are.
Well, I think this is the old way.
We have we have Plan A, we have Plan B, and we have Plan A and a half.
A and a half.
Okay. So, Dick, do you want to tell us what the score is as we start the game again today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. Part of the deliberations yesterday were to discuss conceptual amendments to the Dash 8 and 9 amendments. And what we did is to overnight roll those conceptual amendments into two new amendments. So essentially you have 8 and 9 being replaced by 11 and 12 in that order. All right.
So okay, so for the record, and this is what I heard Representative Scott doing when I walked in. 11 is the former
8.
And that is
the broader,
right?
I would classify it as broader in the sense that it requires that the
it's got full private Attorney General enforcement power.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right, then the A-12s.
The A-12s then replaced the A-9s.
Okay.
And they're limited in the sense that only the Attorney General has the authority to enforce the provision.
Okay.
Of this act.
I'm skipping a few candidates.
And then the middle ground is A-13.
The committee, this is new as of about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, so this will be different. Okay, 13s, what do they do?
Again, the first thing to note is on page 3, line 8, that they look very much like the A-11s, i.e., that's the broader interpretation there. The firms have to be compliant not only with the tobacco, with the cigarette tax laws in 323.05 to 323.482, and the other tobacco products tax laws 323.500 to 640, but also all other laws.
Okay.
And as I explained before, I think the primary concern here is what I refer to as the qualifying statute. Now, when the state made agreements with the tobacco companies in the master settlement agreements. And that agreement required the states all enact in a uniform act, a piece of legislation, and we call that the qualifying statute under the Master Settlement Agreement. And what that does is require that the non-participating manufacturers who are importing cigarettes and are selling cigarettes in this country and in Oregon for this statute must put essentially equivalent amounts into an escrow account as if they were members to the to the settlement agreement. So this would require that they also be compliant with that. Then in 82, section 82, you see the major change.
What page?
Section 82, which is page 8.
Okay.
Now the Dash 12 amendments, the narrower interpretation, would have only subsection 1 under 82. that's under Section 82, where the Attorney General may bring action. And the 12s had allowed essentially that same full power to certain, you know, civil actions by other tobacco companies.
There's the 11s that opened up the...
Right, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So what this says is, again, that any person that holds a permit issued under the Internal Revenue Code, which is just a permit to do business, essentially, to import and manufacture tobacco products, if they're in compliance with the qualifying statute, then they may bring an action to enforce the provisions of this act.
That's your private enforcement.
That's your private enforcement. Who may they bring that against? And this limits who they can bring that action against to a firm that is not a participating manufacturer. Is not a participating manufacturer under the Master Settlement Agreement. So they're not parties to that agreement. And they have to not be in compliance with the qualifying statute. So it's a non-participating manufacturer. They're not a part of the agreement, but they are setting up the escrow account and complying with the qualifying statute.
Okay. So, committee, I'll confess to the 13s as being my idea, but I'll also express no particular pride of authorship. So it was sort of a third way. As I see it in talking with the folks on this bill yesterday, we have the 8s that are wide open as far as private enforcement goes. Then you have the 9s that are that do not allow any private enforcement, but are limited enforcement to the Attorney General. And what the 13s do is basically say that if you are a non-participating manufacturer, but you've signed up and you're paying into the escrow so that you're identified, we know who you are, then any enforcement action against a manufacturer that is non-participating but complying, any enforcement action against that manufacturer would be limited to a proceeding brought by DOJ. That is, DOJ would be the enforcing agent. But as to non-participating manufacturers who are just outlaw, basically, not in compliance, they haven't signed up, we don't know who they are, they're not paying into escrow, they're just totally outside the system, then we've opened them up to the bounty hunters, and it's fair game for those folks. So it's that's why I say that's kind of the middle way, so that if you are a non-participating manufacturer, but you sign up, you register, you pay into escrow, that's a safe harbor for you. Then any enforcement action, if it's over stick count or any other issue of compliance, will be limited to enforcement by DOJ. And my thinking was that might even create an incentive for manufacturers to at least identify themselves and sign up for the program. Otherwise, like you say, then it's open season on anyone who's just going to be an outlaw in the system. So that is that clear enough as to how the 13s kind of split the issue down the middle? Okay, and then I'm glad to have these guys talk about it, and we should invite them up. I know that what they'll probably say is they each prefer their own, or they haven't had time to talk with their people. But I want to at least have a chance to look at that today. Questions before we bring them up? Representative Barnhart, you have.
Well, I don't have a question. I have a policy argument to make, but I'll save that until after we've heard from them.
Okay. Representative Fisher. Let's start with you.
I want you to explain to me, how is this different from drug houses that are illegal, and if they are in my neighborhood as a public person, I can bring action against them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all illegal activity, except in this case, as people involved in revenue, we have far more, well, of course, I guess in either case, but in this case, it's the loss of revenue, and in the illegal trafficking of drugs.
It's impact on community.
It's an impact
on property.
Community and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Pete.
Mr. Chair.
That's a very good question.
Actually, Mr. Chair, the difference I see is that if there's somebody in your neighborhood who you accuse of being a drug house and they're not a drug house, you kind of drag them into a negative situation. And that's kind of the fine line and the nuance that we're walking along here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. And I'm not sure whether you'd like me to address that issue.
Yeah, no, well, if you feel like it, but mostly we're just signing off on any one of these three, or if you've got concerns about any one of the three.
Mr. Chair, let me speak to the Dash 13s. I've already indicated to the committee our position with respect to the what has now become the A11, A12 discussion. Did that yesterday in respect to A8 and A9, respectively. Our position with respect to the A13s is the same as it was with respect to the A8s. That is, we don't object to them, again, because we felt the A9s were adequate. We would have the same position today, that we think those are adequate under the circumstances. And so we would not object if the committee makes the policy choice to go with the A13s. That mechanically won't introduce any difficulty in our enforcement process. I think the A13s do work in the way that the chair and Mr. Yates have described them. That's what the language does provide. And again, as I said yesterday, there are other models in Oregon law that have overlapping private. The concept is a private attorney general, someone whose self-interest may motivate them to bring a claim that also has a beneficial public effect. In the antitrust area, unlawful trade practices involving consumer claims, for example, those are two of the areas in which that is already the policy choice the legislature has made. So, again, we don't object to it. We just think the A9s would be adequate.
Okay. Did you want to pursue your question with him? Or?
Well, I'm just curious as to how there is a difference in illegally trafficking cigarettes and illegally trafficking drugs as far as enforcement by the public is concerned.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I don't think there is a difference in the sense that the public obviously has an interest in both cases in pursuing those violations. With respect to whether one creates a private cause of action, there's at least a functional difference between those, and that is that in the antitrust area, for instance, the state has authorized competitors to sue other competitors. So you have two parties, or you have the plaintiff in that private case presumably has a self-interested economic motive in pursuing their competitor that yields an additional public benefit, namely creating competitive conditions in the marketplace if their allegations are proven. In the drug house area, you don't have competitor versus competitor situation, and that's a distinction. It's certainly true that the public still has an interest in both of those scenarios in stopping that conduct.
Representative Barnhart.
I'll just follow up on that a little bit, if I may. It would seem to me that in the drug house case, a neighbor certainly has at minimum a common law cause of action under a nuisance theory, mm-hmm. or something like that. What's different about this? Why wouldn't anybody have a common law cause of action to prevent people from acting illegally in ways that are detrimental to the health of the neighborhood? In this case, the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think that. I've never analyzed whether. Well, let me just take a step back. The amendments that we're discussing here will create a new statutory scheme to regulate delivery sales. Currently, there other than the general prohibitions on delivery of tobacco products to minors. We don't have a statutory framework that imposes a specific regulatory scheme on this kind of marketing tool. So whether there would be a private cause of action currently for someone who felt that the community generally had been injured by the delivery of tobacco products to a minor, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that the Department of Justice has used existing law to pursue people who have done that successfully. But whether there would be a private cause of action currently, I don't know.
Representative Berger.
I would like to draw some similarities here because we don't want minors to be sold cigarettes because that's an illegal product for them. We don't want drugs to be sold to anyone that's an illegal drug. I guess my problem here, sitting on revenue, where the monies from tobacco go primarily for the Oregon Health Plan and provide services to people that we are now having to eliminate from that plan who will suffer as a result of it, there is more than a casual interest from the public in this being turned into revenue that is owed to the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly agree with that. We have found our collaboration with the Department of Revenue and the Oregon State Police in the Tobacco Compliance Task Force to be a very important function. We don't disagree with that at all.
Any other questions? I guess, you know, the question is, could somebody, even if we don't authorize a private right of action, could somebody nevertheless file a complaint and allege a, as Representative Barnard said, common law basis? And I guess they could. It'd be an open question as to whether or not the court would recognize that claim. And so this just clarifies that, in fact, they do have a claim, no questions asked, if you go with a private right of action.
Mr. Chair, clearly if you choose to write it into a statute, right, there won't be any question about that. I think one thing that the legislative record that we made over the last couple of days would clearly answer if you elected not to go with that policy option is that nobody could infer a claim based on these amendments if you don't provide for it explicitly in the amendments. In other words, I think you're clearly making a choice here whether to provide by statute a claim, whether there is an independent common law-based claim or some other statutory basis for the claim would be another question. But as to these amendments, if you don't put it in the statute, I don't think anybody could argue
right
that the amendments imply it.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's bring up Marshall Kobe, do you want to come up first?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marshall Koba, again representing CITMA, the Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers of America. We are here today in support of what I believe to be the Dash 12s, and for the reasons that were stated yesterday, I think that the AG's position that the House Bill 2368-12, along with House Bill 2490, which will be on the House floor here anytime very soon, provides adequate enforcement in the tobacco world as we see it today. We've had discussions with many of you, and I think that the passage of the bill with the Dash 12s and then the opportunity to come back if necessary, and it may very well be necessary to come back in 2 years to have further discussions about Internet sale enforcement and be the certainty that we can collect whatever revenues are necessary there.
Also,
a number of allegations have been suggested about the revenue side through the Dash. I believe the 11s and now the 13s. We're not certain of that. I don't think the case has been made that the revenue is there, or that the addition of the private side in addition to the AG's office is going to collect any additional revenue. Our concern is that will only allow them the opportunity to litigate us into, as I mentioned yesterday, oblivion by putting their legal counsel into the NPMs, which we represent.
Marshall, let me ask, though, and I understand you've only seen these this morning, as we all have, but if looking at the Dash 13s, you're only subject to private right of action if you're non-participating. That's fine, because that's who you represent. But you're also non-compliant. If you're a non-participating manufacturer who is in compliance with ORS 293.535, then the intent of the 13s was to give you a safe harbor. Doesn't that satisfy? I mean, and again, I understand you've not had a chance to talk to the folks back east, but arguably, doesn't that create a bright line as to who's protected and who's not from this risk of litigation coming in from the big tobacco, the competitors?
Chair Shetterly, we're not sure that the line is very bright. The compliance issue is really, I think, the key here to this whole issue. What is compliance? We've had a situation here recently, and Pete Shepard can speak to this, of one of our members trying to comply with Oregon regulations and getting caught up in a question about stick count. And I think intention was pure, but the question is, what is compliance and what is non-compliance? And I think that is really an opportunity that could be exploited by people that are interested in putting NPMs out of business.
Okay, I didn't draft this. Dick, what is 293.535?
That's Pete, just the definition of non-participating manufacturer.
Pete? Help us out. Is this a bright line or not a bright line as far as what you know about?
The statute book over there.
You understand? Stick count gets you into gray area.
Yeah
right. But.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Pete Shepard, Deputy Attorney General. The question of bright line versus non-bright line carved out by the non-participating manufacturer statute, the escrow statute. I guess what I would say is that the terms of the escrow statute are, in our judgment, bright lines. They say what they say. There is not a lot of ambiguity in our judgment in what those statutes say. Like any statutory scheme, there are challenges in applying that. The facts of cases can get complicated and do get complicated in this area. Everybody involved in these cases is very highly motivated to make the case a uncertain case, and so there's a lot of energy put into the development of the facts in these cases and lots of good legal work by the defendants in this area. And so would I tell you that these cases are all slam dunk cases? No, I wouldn't. The statute isn't that clear. I should say the facts as they're applied, as the statute is applied to those facts, are not always that clear. But the statutory scheme itself is a pretty clear roadmap for any NPM that wants to comply with it. Now, would I say that there are differences between the Oregon Department of Justice and NPMs, in which NPMs assert that they are in compliance and we assert that they are not in compliance? Sure, there are cases like that. There are contested cases in this statutory scheme, as there are in all kinds of statutory schemes.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
I have an additional question,
yeah.
Pete, if I may. One of the issues that's come up, and I think it's whispered rather than talked about particularly, is the are the resources available to the Attorney General? I'm generally familiar with the budget problem that we have right now. I don't know how much that affects your office or the enforcement issues. And one of the concerns that I have is, do you have the wherewithal to actually do the level of enforcement needed in order to deal with what could be a pretty significant problem and a pretty significant blow to our resources because of noncompliance problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, thank you for asking about the department's resources. Let me distinguish between two kinds of enforcement responsibilities. First, our responsibility under the Master Settlement Agreement to diligently enforce the NPM statute. In that area, we do need legislative help. We do need your assistance to fully fund that effort, and we're working with Ways and Means staff, and Mr. Yates is chuckling because we've been working with his staff as well every opportunity. We do need help in that arena. We believe that we have complied, and we're sure that we have complied with our obligation to date to diligently enforce that statute. But we've done it at considerable cost to other programs that we've had to borrow and steal resources from in order to fulfill that responsibility. We didn't think it would be responsible for us to let that obligation go unmet. But we are in the process of seeking the resources we need on that front. On the separate question of resources to enforce the tax compliance with the tobacco tax laws. That is, our effort there is funneled through the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, which in these amendments you have made some changes that will allow that effort to be funded at its existing level, essentially through the next biennium. And so on that front, you've provided the resources to do that. Might we discover in the future, over the next couple of years, that even that amount of resource is inadequate to deal with delivery sales, tax, non-compliance issues? That's possible. That's certainly possible. And that's why we're not opposing the dash 8, now dash 11 amendments, or the A13 amendments, because it won't hurt our enforcement effort in any way to have that, the partnership of those other folks who have other motives for wanting to pursue these claims. I hope that's a response.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
Representative Virgil, you have a question.
I do. If you're in the enforcement and you have a certain amount of money to go out and do your enforcement and you bring in three times that amount of money, it seems to me that you have now paid for that enforcement. Does it not work that way?
No.
In other words, does not the above the line go to the state, and whatever resources you have needed in bringing in that kind of money would seem to me be fair to be returned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think that is the way that the tobacco, if I understand your question correctly, that is how the Tobacco Compliance Task Force is operating. That is to say, you appropriate funds, control that through position authorization and expenditure limitation. We expend those funds, and through that activity, we increase or maintain the projected collections that go in turn into the state's coffers for its distribution. I think, if I remember correctly from yesterday or the day before, Mr. Yates described to you that the budget for 0305 has some X number of millions of dollars already anticipated as revenue that would not accrue to the state if you were not to fund the task force at its level. So I think it operates exactly as you described. On the non-participating manufacturer side of things, under current law, we're not even allowed to recover our costs. So when we go after a NPM for not complying with that law under current law, we can't even recoup those costs from the wrongdoer. That's one of the issues that will be addressed in the House Bill 2094.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for these witnesses? All right. Thank you very much.
One comment with that issue coming up is that the revenue impact, which I provided for the A-10s, I think, fits the later amendment. In other words, the question of where the money comes from, the health plan, or so on and so forth. I'd assumed that the full $1.28 was available.
Okay.
So it is a current revenue impact.
Okay. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm a partner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Philip Morris. I want to just, for the committees, try to put a finer point on the distinctions between the 11s and the 13s, if I may. And I want to make it clear that that we strongly prefer the 11s, but the 13s are certainly better than the 12s. From the perspective of enforcement of this very important law. The key difference, what the 11s allow but the 13s do not, is private enforcement of the new internet sales provisions. Those are the provisions aimed at strengthening the safeguards against internet sales to minors. And we think those are of paramount importance. Under the 13s, whether or not a manufacturer, if a manufacturer was compliant with the escrow provision, there would be no private sector enforcement of the internet sales protections aimed at prohibiting sales to minors. Under the 11s, you would be able to have the benefit of private sector enforcement of the internet sales provisions for protecting minors, whether or not the manufacturer was compliant, and indeed whether or not the manufacturer was an original participating manufacturer or a non-participating manufacturer. That's the policy issue, I think, that's before the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing R.J. Reynolds. I'll be very brief. I just want to emphasize one set of numbers that we talked about yesterday, and a lot of our discussion was a little bit broader than just internet sales, talking about the loss of revenue to the state of Oregon. And that's my emphasis today, is prior to the master settlement agreement, for years and years and years, non-participating manufacturer sales in this country was under 2%. Didn't vary. Didn't move. We passed the master settlement agreement. It is now up to 13% in 5 years, 4 or 5 years. 13%. It is at 13% because non-participating manufacturers, not all of them, but some of them, are not abiding by state laws related to the escrow accounts. And the reason why they've grown from 2% to 13% with virtually no advertising, nothing, is because they can come in and offer their product at substantially lower prices than the participating manufacturers. Plain and simple. It's the marketplace because they are not paying into escrow. Now, is that private enterprise? No, because the NPM statutes were set up to set a level playing field and to protect the funds that come to the state. If the sales of the participating manufacturers go down, which they have if you've lost 11%, the funds going to the states go down under the master settlement agreement. That's what this is all about. So the most important number, I believe, is the growth from 2 to 13% and what is done to this state and many other states. This is an attempt to curb that in one area of sales. The other bill that Representative Williams has been working on deals with the escrow agreement and other areas that need to be dealt with. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, committee. This is the time we earn our pay. We're in work session, and let's see where we go. Representative Barnhart.
Move the 11s.
Representative, okay, let's find out. Representative Barnhart moves the A11s to House Bill 2368. That is the amendment with the broadest right of private action, private attorney general enforcement. Okay. Discussion on that motion?
Yes.
Yeah.
The chair proposed, I think, a policy point of view, and it's a reasonable one. I'd like to propose a slightly different policy point of view when it comes to dealing with these issues. We have, I believe, a strong interest in supporting the master settlement agreement and in supporting the revenues that we derive under the master settlement agreement. I believe that interest on the part of the state of Oregon puts us in a position where the highest level of enforcement of that becomes a very strong interest for us. And I didn't realize he was going to say this, but for precisely the reasons that Mr. Nelson indicated just a few moments ago, that it is in our interest to be certain that all people who are selling cigarettes in Oregon or tobacco in Oregon are in compliance with the rules. Now, we have an additional interest, to the extent we can get there, to have those people be not just the ones who are in compliance with the statute, but the ones who are actually paying into the master settlement agreement, because that's the place where we derive revenue. We don't derive revenue from funds that are deposited in an escrow account unless we win a lawsuit against those companies, which, as far as I know, we aren't even contemplating filing. So from the bald standpoint of dealing with revenue, that we have that interest. We also have an additional interest, a very important interest, in protecting the health of minors. And if I understand the argument, allowing a private action will increase the likelihood that we'll reduce sale of inexpensive tobacco products to minors. I think it's well established in the literature that increasing the price of tobacco products reduces the sale to minors and therefore reduces the likelihood of early addiction to tobacco products. Tobacco is one of the most addicting substances known to man. And from my point of view, if we can prevent eighth graders from using tobacco because it's too expensive for them to buy, that's all to the good. So that's why I would support the 11s, now that I understand what the issue is.
I think Nelson and Gardner were with you until that last statement.
But but I didn't ask them to endorse that.
Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to follow up on Representative Barnhart's comments, because I'd like to go back to the fact that we're cutting off people in the Oregon Health Plan and that we absolutely cannot afford it. And I look for, at the end of this session, people to come to us and say, we really need to do something. Perhaps we need to raise the tax on cigarettes. So I think before we start thinking about where we're going to lay taxes, while at the same time we know that there's money being left that's not on the table by people who are illegally selling cigarettes, makes me much more prone to go in the strongest enforcement possible.
Okay. I hate to prolong this pain. Representative Barnhart's desperate to go testify in another committee anyway, but other comments? Representative Farr, you look like you're ready to say something.
Well, I'm just that I agonized over this. I had a lot of discussions with some friends and people that I trust very much, and I'm going to vote in favor of the 11s for some of the reasons that Representative Barnhart pointed out, very significantly for the revenue, potential revenue impact without a negative revenue impact of enforcement, and you know, I believe that this is a strong statement that will help us to cut down on youth smoking.
Okay. Well, this is as pure as it gets. We've got three choices, and we're going to start with one vote on the First Amendment to get before us.
We need a call of the committee?
A call of the committee. She's with the governor. Let's see how we do. Kathy, please call the roll.
Representative Arnold?
Aye.
Berger?
No.
R?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
No.
Chair Shatterly?
Let's see, it's 5-2. Wanting to be a strong leader and go where my committee is taking me, I'll go ahead and say aye, since they are in already. The 11s are in. Representative Barnhart?
Are we ready?
We are. I think we got all the other amendments in, Dick. Is that right?
I move House Bill.
Wait a second. Let's find out.
The motion needs to move it to Ways and Means.
Okay, I move House Bill 2368 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, I think it's 2-4 of the subsequent referral
to Ways and Means. To the 4 of the
subsequent. Okay, there's the motion to 2368 as amended, and that includes the amendments we did yesterday. Okay, so as amended today by the A11s to the floor with the due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the way to the floor. Is there further discussion on the motion? Then please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
We're
done.
Aye. Williams?
Aye.
Chair Shatterly?
Aye. All right. Motion carries. House Bill 2368 is finally out of here. With that, we don't have any other business, so we will be adjourned. Thank you, everybody.